You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Covert operations are a favorite subject of blockbuster movies, but how much clandestine or undeclared warfare has the United States actually conducted? Larry Hancock and Stuart Wexler trace the evolution of covert operations in their new book called Shadow Warfare, The History of America's Undeclared Wars. It's published by Counterpoint, and I'm very pleased that it brings Larry Hancock and Stuart Wexler to our show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good morning.
The scale and kind of warfare varies. Congress never formally declared war in Korea, Vietnam, or recently Afghanistan or Iraq. What specifically are you examining in your book, Larry?
Basically, we start in 1940, even before the Cold War, and we develop the covert activities authorized by every president from FDR to contemporary events. So basically, when the presidents decided that they couldn't go to Congress and couldn't find the public support they needed, they went covert, and that's what we studied.
Now, Stuart, hadn't there been clandestine operations before FDR?
Nothing at the scale of what we're looking at, but we did have some level of sort of, for instance, in World War I, we got involved with the Civil War in the Soviet Union, would become the Soviet Union, but nothing at the scale of what we have here.
And what did FDR do?
Well, what FDR did was he arranged for what amounts to a secret war in China in response to the Japanese incursion in there.
Now, Larry, haven't nations always engaged in secret acts of aggression? We're seeing that right now in eastern Ukraine.
There's nothing atypical about that. Nations have always turned from diplomacy to what we would call deniable warfare. It's, as Stu said, it's more the scale of what America has been doing and the consistency. I think from our purposes, it's also the manner in which we've done it. Most nations have done it in a very straightforward fashion, where the United States has a real dynamic going on between the president and Congress in terms of deniable warfare and the politics of it.
Do the Obama administration's domestic surveillance programs count as a kind of shadow warfare?
They integrate with what we call gray warfare, and basically that has to do with what happened after the attacks on New York and Washington, D.C., and in terms of actually merging military action and covert action. So they're part of the intelligence collection effort. We do discuss that a bit, but actually not nearly as much a part as what we see with CIA alliances with the Joint Special Operations Command and the terrorist, anti-terrorist task forces around the world.
So, Stuart, spying on other nations' leaders like Angela Merkel or participants at the G20 summit in Canada could be included, but they're not the focus of this book.
No, the book focuses primarily on our efforts to sort of surreptitiously arm, train, and in some cases actually commit ground forces to wars that we never try and associate ourselves with directly.
Has the United States taken advantage of open wars to conduct other warfare in the shadows?
Absolutely. Vietnam would probably be the primary example.
Now, Seymour Hersh, has reported that the U.S. has launched covert actions in Iran and that the Iranians captured a U.S. drone. Is that possible today?
It certainly is possible today. We discuss, and that is nothing new. We actually started covert operations into Iran across the border during our Iraqi activities. There are a number of task forces, joint task forces, that operated across the borders in Afghanistan and from Iraq into Iran, and that started quite some time ago.
Now, the United States hasn't declared war as constitutionally specified since World War II. Why did presidents stop seeking a formal declaration? Was that a conscious decision, or was it forced upon them?
I think a lot of this has to do with, for one thing, Congress's willingness to defer. And they do, and it's important to know, they do pass resolutions and joint resolutions to support the overt wars that we've been a part of. But it, to the extent that declaring war requires sort of a more responsibility of the Congress to monitor and oversee, I think Congress has as much responsibility for deferring as much as anything else.
And then in some cases has complained after the fact that presidents overstepped their powers.
Absolutely. In fact, with the covert wars, it's almost farcical how often they will know about or be made aware of some kind of covert war. And then once it becomes publicly known and that's a big problem, they throw their hands up and start accusing everybody of going around their backs.
Now, after World War II, when the United States and the USSR were facing off, they realized that that overt war had to be avoided. So did covert war became the way of dealing with things to be fought through proxies like Vietnam or Nicaragua?
There's an element of that, but I think the other element is that when you don't have the international legitimacy that you had, for instance, when the UN approved, with a little bit of shakiness, the Korean War, you're playing right into Soviet propaganda and Chinese propaganda if you're seen as interfering in the non-aligned world during the Cold War. So secret wars are your way of getting what you want in the Cold War without having to play into that propaganda.
Larry, did you intend your book to be more of a review of history already known about shadow warfare, or have you found new material that's been largely unrevealed until now?
No, we found a great deal of new material. One of the most interesting things is I would say the majority of what we've learned, even about the earliest decades, has come out only in the last 10, 12 years. A great amount of it due to releases not just from agencies like the CIA, but a great number of State Department documents. Actually, as it turns out, the State Department was much less bashful about recording what we were doing covertly than the agencies that were doing it were. I guess that makes some sense because sometimes they didn't really agree with it. But now I think we've got considerable new material all the way through to contemporary events in the book.
Is the U.S. still keeping a lot of the operations of the 50s and 60s secret a half century later?
Probably not so much the 50s and 60s. What appears to be more secret at the moment is what the U.S. was doing in Africa in the 70s and 80s. And there are a great number of documents there that should have been legally released some time ago that are still being withheld. So I would say not so much 50s and 60s, 70s and 80s in Africa and Latin America.
Do you think that there are actions that we will never know about?
Oh, I certainly think that there are actions that we will never know about. And the interesting thing is, though, that's I think there's some that we will never know about because they were done with no documentation at all, strictly verbally. But I also think that it will be 30 to 40 years before we understand the activities that are going on right now in terms of contemporary covert operations. And covert operations are still very much going on from Libya to Syria and other places.
My guests are Larry Hancock and Stuart Wexler. Their book, Shadow Warfare, The History of America's Undeclared Wars. Stuart, what do you think are some of the most important examples of undeclared or shadow warfare in the past 60 years?
Well, I mean, you can go into a number of places. I think if you look at Guatemala, I would start there, and I'd start there because it set a precedent. It was it tends to be rare that they're actually successful, and it was, by standards of the CIA at the time, fabulously successful. And because of that, they felt the sort of hubris to keep on doing things like it afterwards.
But in its aftermath, we had to deal with Nicaragua.
Absolutely.
The Contra War grew partly out of reaction to what had happened in Guatemala.
Absolutely. And what the government learned was is that sometimes fate helps you be successful in some of these things. But more often than not, it's very difficult to pull one of these operations off.
Well, what's the main reason for conducting such operations in secret? Is it a matter of avoiding constitutional hurdles or allowing yourself plausible deniability?
I think it's a combination of both. As I said, during the Cold War, there's a big part of trying to avoid looking as if you're interfering in the non-aligned world, because that's what you were being accused of by the Soviets and the Chinese. But there's also a sense, especially depending on the personality of the president, that it becomes a much easier path to take than going through Congress or trying to wheel and deal with Congress people.
Larry, how have either the Manning or the Snowden document leaks affected your views on American covert operations?
I would say they're very consistent. I don't know that they've changed them. One of the things that many people have been surprised by is the extent that the State Department and the intelligence agencies and the Defense Department were all linked together at a particular period of time. And the documents released by Snowden show that, and many of them relate to State Department documents. I don't think that was any surprise to Stu and I, but I think the majority of people may be surprised that at the level of integration that there's always been between state and intelligence.
Although you also suggested earlier that sometimes they disagree, and that's why state kept more exact records.
It is. It's fascinating. I think it's tempting to blame these covert operations on the CIA, and that's just what you generally think. But through the span of the book, we find that frequently they're generated by the State Department, by the National Security Advisor, not by the CIA, and the CIA objects to them strenuously. So it's not as routine a pattern as having the intelligence agencies promoting it as one might think.
But has the president had to sign off on all of them?
The president has signed off on all of them, yes. But it's a question of, and we deal this with the book, Stu just mentioned it, it's largely a question of the personality of the individual president and who the influencers are in the administration. It's somewhat amazing to find that the president often simply goes along with a couple of his senior advisors who he trusts and who are much more assertive about particular issues than perhaps even the president is. We tend to think of the president leading, but I think Stu would confirm in many cases we see him simply going along with covert operations.
Kissinger would be the best example. You could go to Casey as the CIA director under Ronald Reagan. Again, Ronald Reagan was a delegator to begin with, so you get a aggressive CIA director with a somewhat passive president, and you have the recipe for a lot of covert war.
And more recently, Dick Cheney has been given credit for being behind a bunch of covert operations.
And I think
we would certainly give him that credit. Yes, we would.
One issue that isn't so secret anymore is the Obama administration's use of kill lists, of what the administration calls the disposition matrix. Have previous presidents used kill lists in the way that President Obama reportedly has?
Yes. If you go back, for instance, to the Cuban operations, even under John Kennedy and Dwight Eisenhower, there were kill lists that were basically set up in the event, for instance, the Bay of Pigs succeeded. There would have been some assassinations and executions that would have happened to try and, if you want to call it, ease the transition over. So we've had kill lists going back a long time.
Individuals nominated for killing have been discussed at a weekly counterterrorism meeting at the White House Situation Room in what's become known as Terror Tuesday. President Obama apparently approves the final list of those to be killed. Has any president done anything like that before?
Not that directly. They have generally – it's interesting with the war on terror that matters have actually moved further, much further up the chain of command. Previously, someone like Eisenhower would simply go into a National Security Council meeting and make a remark that someone needed to be eliminated, and the CIA director would take it from there. For example,
let's get Lumumba.
Eisenhower had Lumumba eliminated. Clinton issued a kill order against bin Laden, and George Bush issued kill orders against not only Saddam Hussein, but a number of al-Qaeda operatives. And it looks very much like he had the same sort of kill list that you're talking about with Obama. We don't really know too much about it because apparently Vice President Cheney gave orders that that was not to be shared with Congress, while the law definitely calls for that to happen.
Have any presidents resisted, or has this been just the way things are ever since FDR?
Well, you know, the funny part about it is, and given who it is, the person who we probably talk least about in the book is the first President Bush. And what's so interesting about that is
he had been the CIA director.
He had once been a CIA director. So the thought Larry and I have is he's probably realized how unlikely it is for these things to succeed and realized how often they blow up in our face.
How is the development of new weapons like drones altering the approach to shadow warfare?
It is enabling, and we do spend a great deal of time in the book talking about the evolution of the weapons, from the kind of weapons that we saw in the Cold War to the highly targeted weapons that we have now. And that goes along with the target list that you just mentioned. Previous to today's technology, there really wouldn't have been any reason for the commander-in-chief to be discussing individuals by name, because that level of targeting simply didn't exist. I think it's interesting, one incident we relate is that Clinton called a meeting and really had issued a kill order on bin Laden, and at that time he was in the Sudan. And Clinton called everyone in and said, all right, we need to take he and his operatives out, and the military came back with a plan to essentially invade the country. Clinton said, well, I really don't want to do that, and the Defense Department said, well, that's what we do, sir, talk to the CIA. And when he turned to the CIA to say, he said, well, we just simply can't do something like that. Obviously, that was then, and we have a different ability now.
But isn't that in the time that we destroyed a pharmaceutical factory?
That was in the same period, and that just illustrates the fact that we didn't have the sort of real-time intelligence that we have. Now it's not just a matter of the drones, but it's the ability to have, through satellite networking, truly real-time targeting. They truly couldn't determine what was going on in that factory. And later on, even in Afghanistan, when they were hunting bin Laden, on several occasions, they would track bin Laden to a location with human intelligence, and then launching cruise missiles from submarines that you still had a 2 or 3 hour lag time. They couldn't guarantee that he would still be there when the missile struck, so they decided not to attack. And in some cases that was very good, because bin Laden would frequent places like hospitals or schools. So it's just a matter that we have a level of real-time imagery and intelligence now that is very much brand new. That doesn't mean it always works perfectly, but it is very different.
My guests are Larry Hancock and Stuart Wexler. Their book, Shadow Warfare, The History of America's Undeclared Wars, published by Counterpoint. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Larry Hancock and Stuart Wexler. Their book, Shadow Warfare, The History of America's Undeclared Wars, published by Counterpoint. You have a chapter on gray warfare. What do you mean by gray warfare?
Gray warfare is really a merger of standard or special operations, military special operations, and classic intelligence gathering. The reason we call it gray warfare is that normally, historically, there was a very sharp divide between what the military was legally authorized to do under their legal codes and what was authorized to the intelligence services under the National Security Act of 1947. That played well, or at least it played, where you had declared wars and where you had Cold War intelligence operations that involve surrogates, not your own military personnel. But in the current war on terror strikes, or overseas contingency operations, as they're called, we're actually using U.S. military, but we're using them often under the legal code related to the National Security Act of 1947, which allows them to do things the normal military wouldn't do. For example, when President Obama launched the raid against bin Laden in Pakistan, he directed it under the legal code pertaining to intelligence operations, clandestine operations, when it was almost 100% performed by military personnel. And this, we go into some extent in the book talking about the problems with this, because it gets into a very gray legal area of military personnel and what they're really permitted to do and what they aren't. But essentially, we've merged two things. We've merged two sets of legal codes, and nobody's revisited these laws and legislation since 1947. Truthfully, the whole thing is very much out of date.
A listener, Dan from New Jersey, asks how much you find that if commanders are working to advance themselves, in the end these operations wind up making matters worse?
Oh, I think there's a lot of instances where you have blowback, and we talked about some of that earlier. What might have seemed successful with Guatemala becomes a template for other places where it does not work. And, you know, the folks on the ground know we were there. The folks on the ground, if the thing blows up and it becomes publicized, the leadership is associated with the United States. And then we create a legacy of resentment in those areas.
Well, how covert was the operation to topple Mossadegh and put the Shah back into power? That is something that we're still dealing with today.
I mean, I don't think people realize.
That was a covert operation, and yet everybody seems to know about it.
Everybody does know most. I think I'll, to cut to the chase, very few of these operations that we trace, and we trace dozens of them over the years, as Stu said, the local people already know what's going on. In many cases, the international community knows what's going on. To be perfectly frank, deniability is often for United States political purposes. We have fooled very few people with deniable operations in the long run, which is why they came to mistrust us so much. But it came back to a political calculus in most cases.
But couldn't a nation targeted covertly argue that the United States has declared war on it, much as the United States did when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor?
I think under international law, there's some basis to that. But, I mean, of course, sometimes, I mean, Pakistan would be probably the best example of this. You know, it's with a wink and a nod in the modern world. The Pakistanis basically know we're using drone warfare in their territory. Publicly, they decry it. The government does. But privately, we're giving them large sums of financial aid and military support. So they let us persist with it.
Has covert warfare been used as a means of forcing domestic support by advancing past a point of no return and then saying, well, we're already committed? Along those lines, can a public relations war of the sort that preceded the invasion of Iraq be called covert war?
Well, in the case of Guatemala, a huge part of the operation was psychological operations or PSYOPs. And you find people in these covert wars who are specialized in psychological operations going from literally operation to operation. So they're definitely a part of the way you sort of manage the situation.
My guests are Stuart Wexler and Larry Hancock. Their book, Shadow Warfare, The History of America's Undeclared Wars, published by Counterpoint. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A story that doesn't seem to go away is Benghazi. It's going to be back in Congress. Does that fit in with the story you're telling here?
Oh, most definitely it does. As a matter of fact, we concluded the book with a short study of Benghazi. And it's very interesting in that there have been some great investigative reporting done that suggests that there indeed was a covert operation going on in Libya to get arms, to prevent arms from going to the jihadi insurgents in North Africa, and to direct arms to the right people in Syria. And that what we saw in Benghazi involved the State Department, the ambassador in particular, and the intelligence operatives, which is one of the reasons there were more people in the annex and more security people in the guarding the annex, which was a CIA facility, than there were in the State Department facility.
So why do you think the story of Benghazi has been told so differently, really, all about the aftermath of the attack and the reasons for the attack?
I think what you get is both sides want to tell a particular narrative about Benghazi when there's basically a third narrative in place. The conservatives want this to be all about incompetence, and there was a level of incompetence. But at the same time, it appears as if the militants who did the attack were piggybacking on protests over the video. So the video is not like a complete hoax story. It was there. And you have a fog of war situation where communications get disrupted. On the other hand, the administration, to some extent, wants to, we would argue, minimize the story about what was happening with supplying arms to Syrian insurgents and trying to keep stuff away from the jihadi insurgents. And, you know, sometimes you cover things up to prevent one angle of a story, and it looks bad overall. And unfortunately, there's two narratives, and nobody wants to see where the middle might meet.
But conservatives have accused the Obama administration of not being supportive enough of the Syrian rebels. So why wouldn't they want that part of the story to be revealed?
I think this sounds like
it gets very complicated.
It does get very complicated, and it comes down, again, honestly, at any given point in time to political agendas, which is why the information is so tightly controlled. Yes, the conservatives would want weapons to get there, but would they really want to admit that the Obama administration was perhaps months ahead of them in trying to get rid of the whole jihadi movement in Syria by getting weapons to the right place? They would not necessarily want to admit that. On the other hand, the Obama administration nor the intelligence agencies are not going to particularly want to admit that they got compromised and the effort failed. What we do know is one very large shipment of weapons went out of Syria with the assistance of the ambassador and his contacts. I mean, went out of Lebanon with his contacts in the Lebanese military before this Benghazi attack happened. And by the way, the Benghazi attack was very much targeted on the U.S. ambassador. So it is an extremely complex story, and you have to look at the timeline. One of the things we always learn is the timeline is more likely to tell you the truth than the various narratives are.
You divide the presidents since FDR into four different categories, active, positive, and passive, negative, for example. You classify President Reagan as passive, positive. What would that mean, and how would that apply to the Iran-Contra affair?
We borrowed this from a very famous typology from a political scientist, Benjamin Barber. And what he does is he has two axes, and one is the president's sort of attitude towards getting things done and the president's attitude towards the give and take of politics. And a passive positive president, for instance, would be somebody who likes politics. So Reagan actually liked politics, but he wasn't like a LBJ-style micromanager. He didn't like actually, you know, pushing the agenda himself. He delegated a lot. And that is actually a huge part of the story of Iran-Contra, because he was willing to delegate to people who had no scruples. And so you get to that kind of a situation.
And then become talk show hosts.
Absolutely.
Where does Barack Obama fill into that system?
It's tricky to sort of categorize him because we don't have as much of a distance. We don't have as many people inside the administration writing narratives. But if I had to take a guess, I would put Obama into definitely the negative category towards his attitude on the give and take of politics, because everything I've read indicates he does not like interacting with fellow politicians, even to some extent in his own party.
Now, we supposedly have a system of checks and balances since we've already talked about how this works out with the president and Congress. What about the courts? Have they had any say in any of this?
That's a very interesting area. And one of the things that has held the courts back, which we discuss in several instances, is the mere fact that the Department of Justice can easily be used as somewhat of a tool by the president. The president asked for opinions, as George Bush did after 2001, and he gets an opinion, and unless that opinion is ultimately challenged in the court, it lends some legal credence to things that the legal profession itself may challenge. But in general, you don't find attorney generals and their staff giving presidents opinions that they think they really don't want. It's much more common for them to deliver what the president's looking for. And on top of that, we record a series of what are called memorandums of understanding between intelligence agencies and the Justice Department, which are essentially agreements that Justice Department will not prosecute actions that they feel fall under the National Security Act. So both the Department of Justice and the court system have been compromised by how these things play out in real life.
Now, we have about 30 seconds left, but I have to ask you about the role of the press in all of this. The press has sometimes respected covert operations, other times felt it necessary to expose them. Have we seen any consistency?
No, I would say we've not. If anything, they enabled them during the early years of the Cold War, no doubt about that. During the 70s, there was a lot of great investigative work in the 70s that actually led to some of the legislation that was passed. Things like Gary Webb and Dark Alliance are an example. The press has had times when it was extremely effective at balancing the situation, perhaps not so much recently.
My thanks to both of you so much for being on our show, Larry Hancock, Stuart Wexler. Their book, Shadow Warfare, The History of America's Undeclared Wars, it is published by Counterpoint.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, sir.